I'm Karen Hart Glass, the host of It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me today. As I mentioned last week, I'm celebrating my 7th year of It's All About Food. And if you're new to this program, thank you. If you're old to this program, thank you. If you're checking in every now and then, thank you. Thank you for caring. There's more and more information out there about how health and climate change are connected, and a lot of it comes down to food. Last week, I couldn't remember what PNAS stood for. I'm prepared today. It's kind of embarrassing sometimes. There are so many acronyms out there, and every field has their own vocabulary and their own acronyms. It's just impossible to keep up. But anyway, PNAS.org has a great article that came out a few weeks ago. And PNAS, are you ready, stands for Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This is not a slacker place. This is a prestigious source of information. And they published an article called Analysis and Valuation of the Health and Climate Change Co-Benefits of Dietary Change. And you've probably seen many different articles coming out, U.S. News and World Report, Time Magazine. Everybody's got their own spin and say on this very impressive article, which was put together by a number of impressive researchers from the Program on the Future of Food at the Department of Zoology at the University of Oxford, and the British Heart Foundation Center on Population Approaches for Non-Communicable Disease Prevention. These are the author affiliations for this report, and there's a lot of great information in it. What I wanted to talk about is how a lot of the mainstream media, like Time Magazine, for example, not my favorite source for information, although I rejoice when I see articles that promote the power of a plant-based vegan diet. Yes. So they reported on this PNAS article, and they entitled it How a Vegan Diet Could Help Save the Planet. Lovely. And but you have to understand that they're just looking for people to buy the magazine and to come to their site. So anything that has a sensational title, they're going to support. And what frustrates me is nothing's objective. And not even objective. Okay, we all have our own bent. We all have our own priorities. But I really would like to see magazines and newspapers really dig deep and do the research, and they don't. They just kind of spin things with a sensational title, and then they move on and kind of contradict everything they've said the following week with another sensational title. It's confusing. It's frustrating. Now, maybe part of the problem is they just don't have the funding anymore to do really in-depth journalism, and that's really a sad thing. And part of it has to do with this wonderful internet that we all love and take advantage of, but makes everyone a journalist and kind of lowers the price that organizations are going to pay for journalism. And a lot of us do this sort of thing for free. And so it's really hard to know what's real and what's true. For example, we just saw this wonderful thing come out of PNAS.org, and everybody's spinning on it, how eating a plant-based diet can also reduce climate change. We've been talking about this for decades, and it's always wonderful when more reputable organizations talk about the power of plant foods and how it's not only excellent for health, but it's what's going to save the planet, at least save the planet as we know it, maybe human life and a lot of the other species. The planet will always be here, or at least it'll be here for a very long time. But Time Magazine, just a few weeks ago, put out an article called "Sorry, Vegans, Here's How Meat Eating Made Us Human." And they were reporting on an article that was published in Nature. And it was the most ridiculous article in my mind. It was about some researchers at Harvard University. That's impressive, right? And the article in Nature had all kinds of impressive charts and graphs and lines going up and down with data. And what did they do? They had a group of people chew meat and root vegetables. And they counted how many chews were required. And they determined through a variety of these different studies and tests that the meat took less chews. And they just theorized. None of this is true. None of this is confirmed. It's just kind of like a fantasy idea that since it took less chews to eat the meat than the root vegetables, that maybe hundreds of thousands of years ago, that's how we evolved and became humans. And everybody like rejoices and says, yes, yes, we needed meat to make us human. And so now we should be eating more meat. I mean, it's just a ridiculous concept. And this was done at Harvard. And you know what I say? I don't care what happened 500,000 years ago, a million years ago. I know what's going on today. We've got 7 billion people on this planet. And we're cramming all of these innocent, sentient beings into filthy spaces so that we can grow them fast and kill them fast and eat them fast. It's a disaster, and it's affecting our health in a negative way, and it's affecting the planet in a negative way. And that's just the simple truth. And it's just really frustrating when you see these ridiculous headlines. And, you know, the latest thing is that the good thing is the word vegan is becoming more and more popular in mainstream media. They're including it in all kinds of scripts in the movies and on television and commercials. Okay, people know about us. So we have to endure this time until we get to the next level where they don't feel like they have to make fun of us anymore. And they realize that eating plants is really the best thing for all of us. And not only is it the best for our health and for the planet and for the animals, but it's delicious. And every time I read in these articles, they always talk about how eating plant food is boring. And I want to say, hello, it's 2016. It is not boring. There's many, many different ways to prepare plant foods. They're far more exciting because there are so many more kinds of plant foods and all kinds of colors. They're really delicious. And even, you know, sometimes I just love steamed vegetables and brown rice. There's nothing wrong with it, but there's all kinds of herbs and spices and sauces and raw nuts and seeds and great things to make plant foods taste great. So I really get tired when I see those kinds of ignorant reactions and keep these myths going. But I highly recommend checking out the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, PNAS.org, and read their analysis and valuation of the health and climate change co-benefits of dietary change. Don't read the summaries in these more mainstream publications. Go to the source. That's where you're going to get the best information, and you can make the most informed choices from the best information, the original information. Okay, moving on. I want to tell you I'm really excited about this. I mentioned it maybe last week. I'm not sure. Dr. Joel Fuhrman, my favorite doctor, he has a new book coming out this Tuesday, April 5th. It's called The End of Heart Disease. And if you're on his newsletter list, he recently wrote that he thinks this book, The End of Heart Disease, is his best, most important book ever. It's his largest book, over 430 pages. He's been working on it for over 2 years, and it's coming out on Tuesday. And guess what? I get to talk to him on Tuesday on It's All About Food. So I hope you'll join me next, excuse me, Tuesday for this really important program. And, you know, so many people have heart disease today, and it's really frustrating when I hear from friends and family and strangers even where their doctors, their cardiologists tell them you have heart disease, there's nothing you can do about it but to take these medications. And that's just not true. And we all need to be spreading this message of the power of plants to save our loved ones and even our not so loved ones. So nobody should be dying of heart disease today, right? I just keep hearing more and more stories about it. And it's very, very frustrating. And I look forward to the day when medical doctors understand that nutrition is a part of good health. Some of them are getting it more and more, but then there's this balance because they feel like we don't want that information. We want to keep things easy and simple. We want the pill. We want the surgery. It's too hard to eat healthy. And, you know, I guess that's everyone's choice. Not my choice. I pick delicious plant foods every day. Okay, so last Sunday was Easter. And if you know me by now, you know I'm not a religious person, but I am a foodie. And I love celebrating food related to holidays. So when people think of Easter, at least when I think of Easter, I think of two, quote, foods. One is chocolate. And then I'll tell you what the other one is in a minute. But let's talk about chocolate for a minute. Last year here at Responsible Eating and Living, my nonprofit, we did a video report called The Chocolate Story. And what I tried to do in that report is bring together all the different issues involving chocolate. And do you know what some of those issues are? There's the issue of, in the Ivory Coast, of children being used, child slaves, to harvest cocoa. And the Food Empowerment Project has been outstanding in updating and producing this chocolate list and letting us all know the vegan chocolates that are out there that do not use child slaves in harvesting their chocolate. Okay, so that's one thing, slavery. Then there's lead and cadmium. And there have been more reports testing different chocolates and finding high levels of lead and or cadmium in chocolate. And there are a number of organizations that have been doing this. There's an organization called As You Sow. And then there's a group called ConsumerLabs.com. Now, As You Sow has been publishing the tests that they're doing. I imagine they're expensive and it's really hard to test every chocolate out there, so we cannot get all the information. Of course, individual manufacturers are supposed to be checking their own chocolate, and you know they either are or they aren't. And if they are and they discover that their cadmium and lead levels are above what is approved by the FDA, are they going to come out and let us know? You know, when it affects the bottom line, we can't be sure. So there are a lot of different chocolates that have lead and cadmium. It has nothing to do with being organic. It has nothing to do with being expensive or low quality. And as we hear more stories about lead in the water, for example, in Flint and in New Jersey and who knows where else, I think you can understand how there are toxins in our chocolate and in other food products, because these products, cocoa, for example, is a plant. It grows in the ground. It's watered. The water may have contamination. The soil might be contaminated from nearby industrial plants. Who knows what? And unfortunately, a lot of chocolate has lead and cadmium. So you have As You Sow, and then you have ConsumerLabs.com. Now, the thing about ConsumerLabs.com is you can only get their reports if you subscribe to their website. There have been a number of other organizations who have gotten their report and summarized some of the results, but they continue to update the results. I don't subscribe to ConsumerLabs.com. Maybe I should, but I don't have the most updated result. But if you really want to know, that might be a valuable report. So they're letting us know which chocolates have high amounts of lead and cadmium and which ones don't. Okay, so we have the slavery issue, we have the lead and cadmium issue. Then for people that are concerned about allergens, the FDA did a study a while ago and discovered many, many chocolates that said they were non-dairy had a lot of dairy in them. And that has to do with the fact that it's really hard to clean those chocolate machines. And there are companies that don't own their own, and they share it with other companies. And even though they may not use certain ingredients in their product, if somebody else uses those ingredients in their product and they use the same machine, even if they say that they don't have those ingredients, there's always that little line in small print saying may contain blah, blah, blah. And they have to say it because it can really have a deleterious effect if somebody has an allergic reaction to peanuts or dairy, other tree nuts. So there are the allergens. There's slavery in the chocolate. There's lead and cadmium. This is really sad, isn't it? Because chocolate's such a beautiful food. So what we did in the chocolate report is try to find the chocolates that don't have slavery in them, that don't have lead and cadmium in them, and don't have allergens in them. And it's really hard to know or get a complete picture because not all the chocolates have been tested. I remember when we did the report, it came down to endangered species was not ideal for allergens, but they were good for lead and cadmium and slavery. But unfortunately, as USO has just reported, that there are some endangered species chocolate that indeed contain is it lead or, let's see, yes, lead and cadmium, both. Equal exchange, organic and fairly traded dark chocolate, very dark, 71% cocoa, has been shown to have lead and cadmium. That's equal exchange, excuse me. An endangered species chocolate, dark chocolate with 88% cocoa, has lead and cadmium. Nice, isn't it? And, you know, Ghirardelli and Trader Joe's and Whole Foods and Cadbury and Hershey's, they're all in there. They all have some lead and cadmium. Not all their products, some of them. So you may want to check out these websites that are doing the reports, and you could listen to our chocolate story that you can find at Responsible Eating and Living. What do? I don't know. All I know is that for Easter, I found the, I don't know how to pronounce this, S-J-A-A-K. How do you pronounce it? Shajak, Jack chocolate. They're out of Petaluma, California. They're organic. They are listed on the Food Empowerment Organization, Food Empowerment Project chocolate list as not using chocolate that uses children to harvest the cocoa beans, and that's good. And they had some very cute little Easter chocolates that I managed to buy and get for Gary. And it was really a fun little moment having Easter eggs and Easter bunnies, and they had vegan little jelly beans. And there it is. There's the Mr. Softy food truck just in time because they have to play while I'm doing this program. Now, the other Easter food, popular Easter food, is the Easter lamb. And this is a hard one. How is it we can have all of these sweet, lovely, peaceful images of this precious baby animal, this cuddly, soft lamb, and then talk about slaughtering it and eating it and serving it up on a platter? I don't get it. And if you can explain it to me, I'd like to hear the explanation. But there are so many beautiful poems about the lamb, the peaceful lamb, the lovely lamb, and then after all the services, people go and eat lamb. Do we really think about what we're saying and doing all the time? Yeah. Anyway, I don't believe in eating lamb. Is it obvious? And that is that. Now, the last thing I wanted to talk about in this first half of the program is something I learned in 2007 when going through my cancer treatment. I was at a point where I knew I really had to dig deep and do whatever I could to save my life. And that meant food, of course. But I knew that there were some other things. And I went to visit a friend of mine in Canada who did some special technique. Some of them were neuro-linguistic. Some he did some Reiki and some other things I think he created himself. But one of the things we did that was really powerful was talking to my body. And back then, the way we did it was he said he was going to ask me some questions, but he wasn't asking me. He was asking the parts of my body that had cancer. And we set up a way for me to answer or for my body to answer, yes or no. And, you know, this may sound crazy, but it was so powerful. So I sat, I relaxed, and he said, okay, let me know what the yes, how you're going to respond with a yes. And I think one of my fingers twitched. So we decided that the yes answer, my finger would twitch. And then the no answer, my eye would blink. Something like that. And then he proceeded to ask a number of questions. And I did my best to really be in a relaxed state and not anticipate an answer. I didn't want my conscious or I don't know how to explain it, but I didn't want my mind to answer. I wanted my body to answer, and it worked. And the answers were profound. I learned a lot. And I don't use this technique very often, but I find it can be very useful. It can be very powerful, and it can be scary. And I believe that our body knows everything about us. I believe our bodies have all of the answers. Why we feel the way we do, the physical things that are bothering us. We have all the answers inside of us. And the question is, do we really want those answers? Because some of them can be scary. And so, as you may know, I had the flu like 3 weeks ago. I can't believe it. And I did. And it lasted a week with fever. And then I had this cough that lasted over 2 weeks, and I'm really kind of at the end of it. And it was a few days ago, I don't know, 4 or 5 days ago, I just had it feeling crappy. And I was in my meditation, and when I was done with my meditation and I was all nice and relaxed and comfortable, I said, okay, I'm going to do this, asking my body what it needs right now to heal and get back to my high, vital, strong energy state. And I just relaxed and I said, okay, what is it you need? And right away, I got this answer: papaya, pineapple, basil, and kiwi. And I thought to myself, okay, this is either crazy or it's not. But I'm not going to judge. I like these foods. Gary and I went out. We got papaya, pineapple, basil, kiwi. You could look at my What Vegans Eat post. We made this beautiful salad of papaya, pineapple, and kiwi. And then I made an eggplant dish with fresh basil in it. Everything was delicious. I ate it. I felt better. Now, I know that the placebo effect is very powerful. And who knows, maybe there was a placebo thing in there, but I really recommend this technique of listening to your body, getting in a relaxed state, listen to your breath, relax your body, and then ask a specific question. You may be surprised what the answer is. And you can ask your whole body. You can ask specific body parts. It can be really, really profound. And let me know how it goes. If you discover something, I would love, really love to hear about it. You can email me at info@realmeals.org. info@realmeals.org. Got it? Very good. the last thing I wanted to talk about in this part before we get to the second part with my guest, who I can't wait to speak with, is soca wraps. Have you made soca? Soca is a crepe made from garbanzo bean flour and water. It's like the easiest thing. If you feel like you're not very good at making pancakes and flipping and whatever, if you have a decent pan, a decent spatula, there are tricks to the trade. It's a very easy kind of crepe to make because the chickpea flour, the garbanzo bean flour, is a very sturdy, sturdy, flexible flour. I like to spice it up. And I made a bunch, maybe like 10 or 12 of them. They make phenomenal wraps. So you can go to responsibilityandliving.com. Check out my What Vegans Eat post. Let's see, which one is it? For day 410. And see what we did with the soca wraps. Really good. Okay. Let's move on to the second part of the program because my guest is here and I can't wait to talk to Miyoko Shinner. Miyoko, welcome to It's All About Food.
Hey, how are you, Karen?
Good. You know, I'm really grateful that you're spending this half hour with me because you are the most amazing person out there these days doing a gazillion things. I don't know how you find time.
Like everybody else, like including you, I'm sure. So anyway.
Yes. Anyway, so we have a lot to talk about because you're just doing everything. And we want to get to all of that. I think right now the thing that most people are excited about is your cheese. I noticed Veg News on the front of their website is talking about your new vegan mozzarella. Let's talk about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the mozzarella is fantastic. You know, I'm really excited about it because it's our first truly meltable cheese. But what makes it different from all the other meltable cheeses on the market, well, there's several reasons. One is that it's something that you can truly enjoy either cold, sliced in a caprese salad or in a sandwich, or melted on a pizza or in a sandwich. And the melting ability of this cheese is absolutely phenomenal. You can't tell it apart from regular cheese. You know, if you put it on a pizza, like a margherita pizza, it really looks like fresh buffalo mozzarella. It bubbles, it browns, it's really melty and gooey. It's absolutely lovely. Once again, it's like all of our other cheeses in that it is a cultured cheese. So we add cultures to it, which is what gives it the unique flavor of cheese rather than adding cheese flavor to it. So we make it in a very sort of traditional mozzarella type of way. We also brine it in brine, which is salt water, to give it extra flavor. So it really is, there's a bit of artistry involved in making this cheese, and I'm really thrilled that we were able to produce this one.
Yeah, well, everybody's excited about it. So this is a great thing. I'm glad it's out there. So we can pretty much get it at, like, Whole Foods, or where can people find
yeah.
it?
Yeah, you can buy it at different Whole Foods stores throughout the country and a lot of independent supermarkets. Natural food stores also carry it. Have we sent you any, Karen?
Not the mozzarella.
Oh, okay, we need to send that to you.
Yes,
okay,
in fact, I was talking right. to Gary earlier, and he said, are we some. Getting any cheese?
Oh my gosh! Okay, gosh, I can't believe didn't I got to put that order in with my marketing director. I am so sorry. I'm going to make sure that you get some next week. So we'll send you.
Wow,
some.
I'm a winner! Yeah. And you know what? I'll take that like as a birthday present. My birthday is in April, so
good. Yes,
that'll be like the beginning of my birthday celebration.
Well,
okay, well, we'll be posting
pizza.
Lots of good things that we'll be making yes. with it. That's for sure. Woo!
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, so here's something I want to ask you. You started making vegan food available for the public with a restaurant in San Francisco a long time ago. You started manufacturing food a long time ago. Then you took some time off, you raised your family, you came back. What's different now?
Well, the whole marketplace is different. The whole world is different. I think people are waking up to the necessity of changing the way they eat because they're beginning to realize the huge impact it makes, not only on their own health, but on the planet, on animals. I think when I first became a vegetarian or vegan back in the 70s and then vegan in the 80s, you know, most people who went vegan did it for health reasons. There really wasn't that much information out there about the environment nor about the unethical treatment of dairy cows. So, you know, people who didn't want to hurt animals basically just didn't eat them. They were vegetarian. But unless you were really, really worried about lactose or something, you know, a lot of people just didn't go vegan. It just, they didn't understand why. Today, yeah. People understand why. There's so much information out there thanks to the Internet and so many wonderful books and publications, all the information that's out there today. It's almost, you know, it's impossible when you look at the facts straight in the eye and realize the suffering that happens to, you know, the whole veal industry exists because of the dairy industry, for example. When you realize the cruelty that that dairy cows have to undergo in order to be able to provide milk for us, you know, it's really hard to continue using dairy products. I mean, it's hard not to go vegan. When you really, really get it. So I think that's really the main difference, is that the world is just so much more ready to make that transition. The world, mankind as a humankind has evolved, is changing slowly and surely towards a more compassionate life. You know, I really do believe that we as a species are evolving for the better. And this is sort of the last hurdle that we have to get over is, I mean, we are treating other humans better. I know there's still a lot of suffering in the world and a lot of wrongdoing, but just overall compared to, you know, the Crusades or something, we've made progress.
Okay, I'm thinking of a couple of things I want to say in response to some of
I'm kind of rambling,
things.
Aren't I? Sorry.
okay, I want to talk just briefly about those cows, those precious cows. There are still people that think if they're buying organic milk, organic dairy, that they think that the cows are treated better, and maybe to some degree they have a little more space, maybe they're getting some better food, but they're still being raped, period.
They're still being raped. Their babies are still taken away from them upon birth so that we can in turn drink their milk. So yeah. They're having their children abducted immediately, and they are very emotional creatures, and sometimes they chase after their calves. You know, there's lots of stories and videos you can watch about that. Not only that, they're still slaughtered. It's not like they spend the rest of their life, you know, grazing in the grass once their milk production goes down. Once their milk production goes down, they're no longer needed.
They're hamburger.
And so they go off. They become hamburger.
Yeah.
So it's almost worse than if you're just a beef cow. At least, you know, the cows that you see grazing the grass outside are typically beef cows. And if you see a cow with a calf, then they're usually beef. And, you know, they look like they're happy, and they probably are for a couple of years until the slaughter truck comes along to carry them off to the slaughterhouse. But dairy cows tend to live most of their lives indoors because they have to be. In fact, it's not just dairy cows. You know, it's the same thing with goats. There's I live sort of in the center of artisanal cheese production. There's lots and lots of very very high-end artisanal creameries where I live. And I was just at a trade show last week where I was my table, the Miyoko's kitchen table, was right next to a high-end goat cheese table. And the woman was really nice, and I was chatting with her about goats because I've started a little rescue, little sanctuary at my house. I have a little farm, and I have goats I've been rescuing. So I struck up a conversation. I asked her, you know, what do you do with your male goats? Oh, you know, they sell them usually when they're babies for meat or whatever. And she made kind of a strange comment. She goes, well, you know, goats are very picky eaters, which I know, you know, it's not true that they eat anything. She says, you know, for example, they don't eat grass. And I'm like, what do you mean they don't eat grass? My cow, you know, my goats eat grass. They're grazing in the grass all the time. They also graze on, you know, they also browse on trees, especially willow, and all kinds of things like that. But they definitely are out there, you know, chomping on tall, green, fresh spring grass. And I kind of looked at her quizzically, wondering, and she goes, oh, you know, but I mean, our goats, they only go out 3 or 4 times a year. Mm. And I said, what do you mean they only go out 3 or 4 times a year? And she's like, well, you know, they have to be indoors because they're for milking. So that's why she doesn't, even though she's had goats for 30 years, she doesn't know that they actually do eat grass because her goats are indoors. I mean, this is, you know, how the industry operates. These poor goats that are chev makers, are confined to a life indoors, except for 3 or 4 times a year. So that's the industry. That, and then, you know, their babies, of course, are taken away at birth and sold for whatever, for slaughter or whatever else, maybe 4-H if they're lucky. So
there's this romance around goat cheese, goat butter, and
goat
milk.
There's so much romance around, goat cheese. And it's, you know, it's not very romantic when you see the life they lead.
It's healthier because the goat milk molecule is supposed to be more like the human milk. But it's not without exploitation, as you just described.
Well, why don't we just have moms donate milk, you know, like human moms, and we can start making breast milk cheese.
Sure, and pay them for
it. That could be cruelty-free, right? I mean, and, you know, moms could get paid for contributing their milk.
But, you know, the natural reaction is what? Ew!
Ew, it'd be ew. And then, you know, what do the babies eat? Well, the babies would then have to drink formula. And then people would say, well, that's really cruel. That's unnatural. But that's exactly what happens to these poor dairy cattle and goats.
You know, so, I'm wondering, you said that Miyoko's Kitchen, your cheese factory, is near some other artisanal creameries, and that must put a lot of cultures in the air that all of you share.
Oh, I don't, you know, there's cultures everywhere in the air. It doesn't matter where you are, and there's cultures on apples and lettuce and just about everything. There's basically, the cultures are lactic acid bacilli, and they're everywhere. They're everywhere to be found in the air, on fruits and vegetables. It's all over the place. But, you know, as a small batch artisanal operation, you know, we have clean rooms and air filtration and all of this. And they all operate in the same way. And we buy non-dairy cultures from a proprietary, you know, a proprietary blend that we buy, that we source, you know, that are made in a lab or grown in a lab. So, it's, you know, we're not making, but as they ferment, as they age, they do capture additional cultures or bacteria and yeast from the air, which is, of course, gives it a unique flavor. And that's the case wherever you are in the world. You're going to, you know, if I make cheese here and take the same recipe and make it in, let's say, France in a certain area, it could taste slightly different because of whatever is present in the air.
Now, speaking of France, the last time we spoke, I think your cheese company was just starting. And you told me that you were working with these French cheesemakers, and they were actually becoming curious about what you were doing. So is there an update on that story?
Well, the people that I was working with were sort of consultants who helped us design our aging room. So, you know, we're not working, they kind of played their part. We're not working with them right now, but they were very, very intrigued by what we were doing. In fact, they were teaching a cheese class and giving some lectures on cheese at a cheese festival locally, a big one, and they thought it'd be really interesting to sample our cheese. So, you know, we sent it to them, and I don't know if I told you this story or not, but somehow there was a mix-up, and our cheese got served at the wrong event, not the one where they were going to be, you know, deliberately talking about it, but it got served at the regular cheese event. Not the alternative cheese event, but they got served at the regular cheese event and just served alongside all the other cheeses and presented to people as dairy cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And no one knew the difference.
Of course.
And people loved it. So there you go. And these are, you know, these weren't vegan. So, you know, they weren't vegan.
Did that really happen by mistake? Or maybe the universe wanted that to happen, but
yeah,
it's a great story.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Okay, so the cheese is really good, and I don't know, but I think history is going to look back on you, Miyoko, for really doing some groundbreaking work in terms of plant-based cheeses.
Well, that is very, very generous of you to say that.
It's true. I mean, I know a lot of people have worked on cheese, but I think you've done more than anybody, in my personal opinion.
Well, thank you very much. Yes. So I'll let you record history, okay?
Oh, history. If we're here in the future, I hope so. But that will just require everybody moving from dairy cheese to plant-based cheese, amongst a few other things.
It's going to happen because the alternative isn't viable and it's not sustainable.
So, that's right.
Now, we're running out of land. We're running out of resources. We're running out of all sorts of things that will make this industry just sort of self-destruct eventually. I don't think we're too far off from that.
No, I want to talk more about deliciousness. Can we talk about butter?
Yes.
Butter.
Oh, butter. Oh, yes.
Let's
slather
talk about
me
your butter.
In vegan butter. You know, it's delicious. It's a cultured. We just came out with a cultured European style butter, and you're in New York, so Whole Foods carries both our mozzarella and our butter. We start out with cashew milk. We make our own cashew milk, and we add cultures to it, and we ferment the cashew milk, so it develops this sort of tangy flavor. And then we combine it with coconut oil, organic coconut oil, of course, and some other ingredients to produce. And then we churn it, so it's a whole new churn on butter. And it's shaped like butter. It looks like butter, like a European-style butter. And you can do whatever you want that you normally would with dairy butter with this butter, whether it's lathering it on your pancakes or, you know, on toast as thick as cheese, or you can melt it, you can whip it to make buttercream. It browns like butter, which is what, margarine doesn't brown, but this does brown. It's absolutely lovely, and we have won a couple awards for it. We were at the Natural Products Expo, which is the largest natural products trade show in the world. We were there a couple of weeks ago, and we won the coveted Nexty Award, and this is an award for innovation, innovative new products, and we won out of 500 nominations.
Oh,
so,
everybody!
I mean, the butter did, so that was a huge honor.
Woo!
Yeah,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so we were thrilled. The butter
now
is great.
Is the butter you're selling similar at all to the recipes you have in the Homemade Vegan Pantry?
It is similar. It's not. It's better because in my book is not fermented. It's not cultured. It's kind of a quickie recipe for someone to make at home. This is the one we make here is a 3-day process. So that gives you an idea of there's an extra layer of flavor that is hard to capture when you just do it at home, unless you go through that whole, fermentation process. So, there's a lot of wonderful things you can do at home. You can definitely replicate, almost everything we do, you can do at home if you want to take the trouble to do so. Just like with any good dairy cheese, you can make it at home too if you take the time and the effort and have the proper equipment. So we just want to make it easy, I mean, not everybody wants to spend a month making cheese, so we want to make it for you. It's the same thing with butter.
Now, the cultures, they're actually good for us.
They are. They're lactic acid bacteria. So they're basically, what we like to call probiotics or whatnot. They're healthy for the gut. Fermentation is one of the keys to health. And man has been fermenting food for thousands and thousands of years. So definitely any food that contains a fermented component is going to be good for you.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to travel. Tell me about what's going on with you and travel and how people can get involved and where that's going to be very soon.
Oh, okay. Well, actually, the big trip that I'm taking this year, I'll be at various events. I'll be at Marshall, Texas this weekend speaking at Health Fest, and I'll be in Hawaii later this year speaking for the Hawaii Vegetarian Society, and I'll be at Summerfest in Pennsylvania in July. But the big trip that there's actually only 2 spots left for people.
Wow.
Is a trip to Italy, to Puglia, which is this, it's sort of the heel of Italy. It's a very remote sort of rural area. I'll be going there, as part of Vegano Italiano in September 25th to the 1st. And it's really a culinary tour into the heart of Italy. We'll be going into places that that are off the beaten track, spending an entire day at a winery. We'll be going to farms and picking stuff and cooking it together, learning how to make fresh pasta, just feasting lunch and dinner on just delights of the region, which are largely vegan because it's an agricultural area where they've been eating largely vegan food for, you know, for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So that's going to be a phenomenal trip. And if you're interested, you know, you can just Google Vegano Italiano or call Green Earth Travel, greenearthtravel.com, or Vegano Italiano, veganoitaliano.com. If you can't make the trip with me, Juliana Hever, the plant-based dietitian, is leading a tour in July, and Fran Costigan, the diva of vegan chocolate and desserts, will be doing her own tour in Sicily in October. So there's opportunities for people to come and participate. But I hope you'll be able to join me. Two more spots if, you know, two of your listeners
are
available.
Spots.
I'd love to have you join me.
Will you be bringing any of your cheeses?
I will. In fact, we're going to be doing a wine and cheese sampling at the winery that we're going to be spending a day at. So I'll be bringing cheese, and we'll be doing a very, very leisurely wine and cheese tasting, along with tasting many other things, of course. But it's an area where they make their own. Everyone makes their own olive oil. People make their own wines. Everyone grows their own vegetables. You know, people live today much as they have for hundreds and hundreds of years. So you get a real insider's perspective of Italy.
Really beautiful, lovely, romantic, delicious.
Absolutely. It's all about food. You know, that's really what, when you can have good quality
food. It's all about food and not about convenience.
I've never heard that before. It's all about food.
It's all about food. But, you know, we have to, sure, you can go and travel to a place, but you have to appreciate the time, the effort, the love, the things. They require quality and nothing artificial and cheap and assembly line. This is art, and it's worth it.
It really is. It really is. And that's where we have to go back as a species, as humans. We have to go back to the way we have been eating for hundreds and hundreds of years, really. I mean, you know, and just really get in touch with the foods that really matter to us, which are pure and clean.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the goats and this sanctuary. So tell us a little bit more about that. How many goats do you have, and where do they come from?
Well, we moved to a ranch last summer with this crazy idea we'd start rescuing animals. And the first animals we rescued were two goats from Animal Place, which is a wonderful sanctuary in Grass Valley. And, in fact, we're going to be doing a fundraiser for Animal Place at my house on May 22nd. So if anybody wants to attend that, be sure to just go to animalplace.org. But anyway, so we got these two goats, and they were strays. They were males. They're of a breed that's specifically known for dairy production. But the males, of course, are... The males, of course, don't produce milk, so they're usually, as I mentioned, either sold off or sometimes abandoned if, you know, they don't grow big enough for meat or whatever. So anyway, so these two were abandoned in a field. So that's where they came from. And then I have another goat and another sheep that are in love with each other, Benny and June, named after that Johnny Depp movie. But anyway, Benny and June are two oddball you know, different species that love each other, and they were raised in a dog run, isolated in a dog run without any grass or anything. They really had never walked more than 4 feet. It was like they had spent six years old. So we rescued them from Farm Sanctuary, or not rescued them from, but Farm Sanctuary rescued them, and then we adopted them from Farm Sanctuary.
Yeah.
And then we also have three pigs. Three pot-bellied pigs that were once again purchased by somebody as pets, and then the man died, and then they had to find a new home. And you know, and then we have 17 chickens, including two roosters, one transgender rooster, one rooster that we thought, everybody thought, including Farm Sanctuary thought, was a hen, and after 9 months, all of a sudden started displaying rooster-like qualities and then turned into a full-blown rooster about, you know, 5 or 6 months after they normally, you know, become roosters or reveal those rooster-like characteristics. So that was sort of unusual. We're going to be adopting more animals. We have plenty of room. We have lots of acres. So, and it's wonderful. I've had wonderful volunteers that have stepped up and helped me, you know, when I travel or whatnot. So animals are getting attention and lots of acres to roam.
And where is this?
Yeah, we are in West Marin, which is kind of north of San Francisco, and it's absolutely lovely. And I don't know, I find so much peace being with the animals, like I've never found. I could spend hours and hours and hours, and if, when I'm with the animals, you're just sort of in the moment with them, connecting, and you're not thinking about anything else, and all your worldly troubles just go away. Because nothing really matters except, you know, I don't know, giving them another willow branch to chomp on.
I was just talking earlier about the Easter holiday, and one of the things that's important for many people during Easter after they've gone through their services and talked about the precious, peaceful lamb is to go and eat lamb.
And Isn't that strange?
Isn't that strange?
I just don't get it. I just don't get the disconnect at all. And, you know, where I am, I'm in farmland. So, we're surrounded. The name of our little sanctuary is Rancho Compasión. But we're surrounded by all these ranches with everything from, you know, there are lots of horse ranches, but lots and lots of cattle, sheep. They're just all over the place. Down the street, you see the little veal crates. You know, the little white huts that you, if you didn't know what they were before, if you ever drive to the country, you see these little white little huts that are lined up one after the other. They house individual veal calves that are very sad and lonely and are just awaiting their day of slaughter. So to be your
dinner.
There's
another human invention. So anybody can just Google veal calf what do you call them? Containers or, you can get pictures of them. It's just another obscene human creation.
Yes, it's absolutely awful.
Okay. So and you can see them in the Marin, West Marin area.
Yeah.
That's lovely.
Oh yeah. You see them. And sometimes I just feel like pulling over and just, going and rescuing one of them.
But yeah, of course, but then they'd put you in jail.
They would. So I just keep hoping that, you know, one of them will just escape or something and be by the side of the road, and I'll be able to put it in my car and drive off or something. But,
well,
anyway.
That's, again, where money could really help, because if we all could, we could buy up all of those animals and save them. But then they'd probably just artificially inseminate more and make more.
Yeah.
So the trick is to stop eating them. And one way to do that is to move from dairy, cow-based and goat milk-based cheeses over to the plant-based, nut milk-based cheeses. And that brings us back to Miyoko's Kitchen. There's lots of choices. Do you have any, in addition to the mozzarella, are there some new flavors that have come out recently?
No, the mozzarella and the butter are two big regular SKUs that we just introduced. We'll probably do more limited edition ones. Last year we had a small limited edition run of a new flavor almost every single month just for fun. And we'll probably start that up again. We're growing so fast. We haven't put any energy into new flavors at this time, but we have a lot of other new retail products that we have in the pipeline for introduction later this year and next year. So keep tuned. And if you can't get it at your current natural food store, just ask for it. We've got nationwide distribution now. So if it's not near you now, it will be sooner. It will be soon. So, just talk to your store if you can't find our products.
That's good. Is there a favorite flavor? Cheese that
for me,
for you and for your customers.
Well, definitely mozzarella is selling like crazy. And there's pictures all over the internet of people making pizza with our mozzarella. So that's really popular. The butter also is phenomenal. And then in terms of the artisanal cheeses, my personal favorites are probably the Mount Vesuvius Black Ash,
which is
an aged cheese. Yeah, I love the Smoked Farmhouse, and then the Loire Valley in a fig leaf, which is a seasonal item. We're out of stock now because we ran out of fig leaves, and we'll start producing it again probably in May when fig leaves come back in season.
So I'm just curious. You started this, what, 2-3 years ago now?
No, in September of 2014. It has been
okay,
a year and a half.
Not even 2 years.
No.
Have the flavors developed at all, or they're pretty much the same for the cheeses? And do you have some that you're aging a little longer, or not really?
Well, that's the issue. Right now, we are actually looking for a larger facility to move into because we have limited aging capacity, and we can only age so many thousands of units per month in our aging room, and that limits our production. I would love to age. Okay, we do have cheeses that we have aged just as an experiment for several months, and they are absolutely phenomenal. And we'd love to be able to introduce a line of cheeses like Parmesan and things that are aged for, 8 to 12 months. We don't have the capacity right now, so right now we have to, I would say the cheeses that we release are on the young side, meaning that, they could be aged longer, but we have such demand that, we're pushing them out a little bit sooner than we would like to. But they're still delicious. And if you ever get a young cheese, like one of the farmhouses that seems not quite as hard as you like, wrap it in wax paper and keep it in your refrigerator, it will actually continue to age in your fridge and get harder. Some of the cheeses, I've had in my fridge for over a year, and they can become like a Parmesan in that you can grate it very, very finely over pasta or something. So,
wow, that's exciting, and we have a lot to look forward to. So, Miyoko, thank you for joining me, and it's all about food and for everything that you're doing for cheese and butter and everything. This is really wonderful. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Okay, take care. Be well. Travel
okay,
safely.
You too. Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. That was Miyoko Shinner. And you can check out more at miyokoskitchen.com. And if you haven't tried her cheeses and now her butter and mozzarella cheese, I hope you do that soon. I'm Karen Hart. Glad you've been listening to It's All About Food. Join me at responsibilityandliving.com. Send me emails at info@realmeals.org. And remember, have a delicious week. Bye-bye.